You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Michael Rosenbaum. My birthday was this past weekend. I'm just going to say it. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I just heard a few of you while you're driving to work or in the house or, you know, in bed nude. Say happy birthday in that in your head. I felt it. So thank you. 48 years old, man. You know that whole thing where they always say, you know, I don't feel 48. Or I don't feel 80. I've still got my body. My body feels like shit, but I don't know what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say is everybody always says, well, wow, how did I get to be this age? Whether you're 60 or 70, and you're like, I still feel, and it's true. I still feel like I'm in my 20s, man. I do. I just feel, maybe if you listen to me and you watch some of the movies I do and the things and my Instagram posts, you're like, well, look at you. I mean, you act 20. Maybe that's why you're single, buddy. Hey, all right. Ever think of that? But I had a great birthday. My friend Harland Williams, very funny comedian, Dumb and Dumber. Actually, he did a little segment on my Patreon. One of my best friends in the world. We've done a lot of trips together. But he's got a pool and a backyard, and I haven't really done anything in months. And so me and a few friends, we all got tested before, and we all spread out in his yard and swam. And it was great, man. It was great. It was exciting. I felt, you know, there's six people there. It just felt like, hey, and I got a lot of nice gifts too. Look at this. Hold on. I got this. This is a Inside of You pillow. It's a pillow. Leah and Kristen got it for me, and it has all the names of everybody that's been on the podcast inside of you. Look at that. It's pretty incredible. I really love that gift. They sent me a nice. And I always say, hey, don't get me anything. I really have everything I want. Just, I have good friends and, you know, you guys out there, it's enough, you know. And, but when you get something, it's still, you know, I'm not going to say, like, especially when it's a good gift. You're like, holy crap, this is, I'm glad they decided to get me. No, they didn't have to get me anything. These, you know, and just to talk about Patreon for a second, you know, all my listeners, those that really love the podcast extra and then want extra footage and supporting the podcast. These folks, there's like 550 of them that are just amazing. And, you know, it's a great thing. It's a great community, but, they're so giving, they're so loving. And, you can't help, but I feel like it's not just, this is a Patreon and fans can go watch stuff. I feel like it is it's something special for me. And especially during this whole COVID time, this whole virus thing and all, it's just like, I feel like I have something more to do. And I know, I just love the podcast and some good stuff coming your way. I can't tell you right now, but, some good stuff could be potentially great stuff. Also for the podcast, before we get to the guest, got new mugs. They'll be on the Inside of You store shortly. But they're a different color and Inside of You cool mugs. Look at that. Boom. Boom's inside. Thank you for allowing me to be inside of you. Limited supply. And, of course, we got the masks. This is the face mask. Say Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. So that's kind of nice, kind of neat. You can get those on the Inside of You online store. At the end of this, we'll read a fan letter like I try to always do. We'll read... give my patrons some shout outs. The other patron too, Where Have All the Good Horror Movies Gone with John Heater and Michael Rosenbaum. You can look at that. A lot of fun. We do Zooms and all that stuff anyway. You know, and also a shout out to my good buddy, Preston Christensen. He turned 15 on July 8th. I hope he got his presents by now. Bought him a bunch of cool stuff. We both love Jim Croce. That's all I'll say. The singer, you know, I have to say I love you in a song. But he's had 8 surgeries for cancer. He's 15 years old, and he's been through so many radiation and chemo treatments, and I love him. He's like a little brother to me, and I've become a family member of this family, Michelle and Chris and Chandler and Renee, and, you know, thanks to Lisa Fox for 104.3 FM in LA for giving Preston a shout-out, and Nico for putting him in his little video game, The Bionic Kid, that you can get the app for. He put Preston, a character of Preston. It's just nice. I definitely, when I do things for other people, I feel better about myself. I feel better. It makes me feel full, you know, or just, I don't know, better, I guess, lack of a better word, better. It's amazing how you hear gratitude can do so much. And I'm telling you by experience, before I go to bed, I think I've said this, but, you know, I close my eyes. And those nights that I remember to do so, I close my eyes and think of things that I'm grateful for. I get an image of my grandfather, an image of my grandmother, an image of whatever it is, Preston. If I happen to fall asleep, which I do, my dreams are better. I sleep better. I'm going into bed with a healthy mind, I guess. Call it cheesy, whatever. I mean, you've been with me for a year and a half, so I think you're here. You're not going anywhere, I hope. Let's get into it. This guy has been around. I say that in a very admirable way. He's very intelligent, went to a prestigious school, but he seems like one of the guys. He's an intense actor, somebody who has done a lot of work, has appeared naked on stage. I don't know if I could do that. I'd probably have to stretch it out, if you know what I mean. But you know him from Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel, and he's just done a ton of stuff. He's a great guy, and we had a really good conversation. He got very personal, and I hope you enjoy this. This is goes out to a lot of the Patreons who recommended him. I always try to listen to your comments on Patreon and the guests you want. I do my best to get them, and great guests on the horizon, too. I can't wait to share with you. All right, let's get into James Marsters.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
Where are you right now? You're at your house, but where are you at? Where do you live?
I'm in Los Angeles, sunny Los Angeles. That's where I am.
Have you lived at this house for a while?
Yeah, I've lived here for about 17 years. I was living in Santa Monica, and I had a little tiny one bedroom and a fourplex. I was on just getting off of Buffy and Angel, and it saved all my money. And then
you lived in an apartment, and then you saved all your money from Buffy and Angel, which was probably a decent amount of money.
Yes, it was by the end of it. Yeah. So it was 6 years. So there was a good amount of money. And then I took my niece on to raise her, and I needed a house, good school system, and a nanny. Like, I needed a 4-bedroom freaking house. And I went and got a house in a neighborhood with a good public school system, and the money just went
like gone.
The money that I'd saved, you know, and I had to figure out how to make house payments and keep the lights on without being on a regular on a TV show.
Now you've been working,
but I did.
I mean, you've been working like crazy. I read all this stuff. You know, I do a little bit of research, not much, because I just like to shoot the shit and find out what makes people tick and what adversity they face and all the stuff that and how they keep going. And I find that stuff more fascinating, which I like to tell my guests. But it's not that I don't care about your career. And you've had a big career and you have a huge fandom. You know, yeah. Buffy and Angel, you've produced or been in a part of 70 plays or many, many plays. You went to Juilliard for a couple of years. You did all these things. And it's pretty amazing. But the first thing you said, and you started it, was I had to raise my niece.
Yeah.
So how did that happen?
That's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Well, why did this happen?
My brother couldn't get it done. You know, my little brother has a dual diagnosis, and he's a good man, but he was not able to take care of her, and he asked me to. And she was 5 and a half.
And how old were you?
40, I want to say. Yeah, 40.
I mean, that's not an easy thing to sort of...
No.
No. Your first answer probably is, wait, let's think of some options here. Your response certainly wasn't, absolutely, I'm in.
It kind of was.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's for I don't know, like for a lot of families, an uncle stepping in and raising a nephew or a niece is not really abnormal. It's not, you know, it is a big ask, definitely, but it's not that weird, you know? Maybe it would be, maybe it's weird for a Hollywood actor to say yes.
Yeah, I have to say, honestly, with all sincerity, I think if my brother said, hey, you know, I'm going to have to ask you to take care of my daughter, I'd say, no, that's not going to happen. I don't know what I would say. I mean, look, to be honest, I mean, you know, you don't know what you do until you're in that situation. And then you sort of go, okay, wait a minute. Am I the best person for this job? Because I look at myself like, dude, come on, man, you live alone. You're, you know, what are you going to take care of something? You got two dogs. Were you worried? Could you do this?
Yeah. Well, that was the first thing is that I was the only one in the family that was willing. Everyone else had said no. So, and then the second thing, I guess I was the last one asked. So the initial ask was, you know, no one else is willing. So it's either you or she's going to go into a foster home. And I know enough about little girls in foster care to know that that really wasn't going to be a good outcome for my niece. Well, she's my daughter now. And yeah, I was crazy worried, man. I was already a father, but I was a weekend father, and we would shoot Buffy. We shot about 70, 80 hours a week. And then I would get in a car on Friday night or early Saturday morning and then drive 350 miles to go visit my son, which is like a whole nother adventure. And then spend the weekend with him every other week and then come back and keep shooting. I had experience being a parent. But that is the difference between being the good time weekend dad and being the one, the dad who's going to be enforcing structure, is just a night and day.
Hey, wait a minute. You're glitching. You're talking and I'm seeing your mouth, but it's like glitching a little bit. Let me see you now. Start talking. Please be good.
Please be good.
Oh, that's, I think. Better? Oh, yeah, bro. I think we have what we call, right? Some people
and
call.
And I think that my skin texture also looks.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal. So.
Yeah. Okay. This is good. This is good. We're good now. We're good.
Yeah.
All right. So we were talking.
Saved
and
by my wife again.
Thank you, Mrs. Marsders. Is that her last name?
Yep.
What was her name before?
It was Raman.
Raman?
Yeah, she is half Bangladeshi and half German.
Ooh, does she speak German?
She does.
Does she ever speak to you like sprechen Sie etwas Deutsch?
Oh yeah, all the time. She sings in German.
Does she say "Halt's Maul"? I mean, shut your mouth.
I don't remember. I don't speak German.
Shut your mouth, James. Enough with your Buffy shit. No one wants to hear this anymore. I'm tired.
It's old news. It's old. No,
it's old.
He has no discernible accent whatsoever.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
I kind of like a little German accent. I don't know. I've went out with German women before. I always liked the accent. Like, Michael, you have to slow down. You talk too fast. I'm like, I know. I'm sorry.
No, she knows. In some ways, she knows English better than I do. She'll be able to spell a word that I don't know, or there's some in some situations punctuation that escapes me. I'll go and ask her about it, and she'll know things I don't know.
Yeah, that's usually the case for me. I never know anything that's right when it comes to English. I never say the right thing. I never do the right thing. I never spell the right thing.
We're Americans. We were not really educated, really.
Yeah, not as well. Not as well. No. That's just, what are we going to do? But, all right, so you take on your niece who becomes your daughter. And what's her name?
You know, I'm a little... The one thing that my daughter has asked me is to keep her out of...
social.
She does not want any reflected celebrity whatsoever. She's really
good.
Clear about that.
Good for her. Doesn't want to be an actor, though, right? She doesn't want to be an actor.
Hell no.
Well, there you go.
She's a mathematician. She's going for her doctorate.
Whoa.
In mathematics. And for now, she's closing in on her master's right now. See, I'm bragging again, which is me. I'm talking about her. She's an amazing person. She's my phoenix, and she...
did you get good grades growing up? Were you smart? Did you excel in math and literature and all these things in high school? Were you a smart guy? You see, because you're a smart guy, so obviously.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, Mike, I grew up in a highly intelligent family, and I came to understand, at least in my family, that intelligence more often than not was just used to rationalize insanity or ill behavior. and that high intelligence often is just people spinning their wheels in the mud. And so, yeah, I.
That says so much to me.
Intelligent. I would. Yeah, I guess I would say that I'm intelligent. I don't know how good that is, really.
I really like the way you said that, though. You almost said like really intelligent people. It's like almost like it's a cover for almost like they have ill intentions in a way, like where they can get away with bad things because they appear to be so knowledgeable, or, you know, is that.
Or just to myself, you know, I have a capacity to rationalize myself to myself and tell myself that I'm doing the right thing when in fact I'm not. And so that my intelligence is actually a tool for me to deceive myself. And I notice that in other intelligent people too.
Don't you dare look at me and say that.
No, I was just thinking, you know, I did a play where this guy, was pretending to be, a person, someone with a very low intelligence, very low intelligence. He was a murderer who was trying to get away with it in this way, or hide and then kill people. It was a play. And so I went and hung out with a community of people of very low intelligence, and they were supremely happy, good people. It was absolute joy to be around them. I felt good every time I was around them. Whereas, I mean, when I hang out with you, I got to say I am very happy. You're a great guy.
There you go. See,
I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but oftentimes when you are talking with someone who's very intelligent, especially someone who's very intelligent and is very proud of that, or really taking themselves seriously, or trying to prove how intelligent they are, I was like, right. It's really annoying, don't you think?
You know, I remember. I mean, yeah, she's not listening to this anyway, but I remember being at Carrie Fisher's party, not to name drop, years ago. And she had a couple of drinks, maybe, but I remember Sharon Stone going on and on about how high her IQ was. And I thought my friends would punch me in the face if I said that once. She's like, oh, I have a very, very high IQ. My IQ is extremely high. I'm like, wow, you're brilliant. Yeah. I just sat there going, wow, she's really saying this out loud. And a couple of us were looking at each other like, wow. But, you know, you said.
But really, really I interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Really intelligent people have the capacity to explain things that might seem complex in a very simple way. Like the kind of intelligence that I really respect. Like, I remember, what's his name? Macaulay. Is this older actor in Chicago explained Hamlet to me. And Hamlet had always been this great play with big themes and all this complexity. And he was just like, no, it's just about a teenager who's wondering if he should kill himself because he finally realized that the world is totally messed up. That's it. That's the whole thing. You know, does Hamlet give up or does he try to change things? Does he try to make a difference, or does he just, once he really learns how infinitely screwed up his surrounding world is, does he just kill himself or give up, or does he try to affect positive change? And that's it. I was just stunned, you know.
Wow.
But it took someone of very high intelligence to kind of to bring that, to be able to pare it down to its simple truth.
I wish people would do that. I wish instructions, like instruction manuals for like fixing a lamp or things like, I wish they would just say in one sentence, this is all you have to do. I start looking at things and I just get overwhelmed by everything. Everything overwhelms me. I don't like reading directions. I just try to wing it. You seem like a direction guy. You look at the directions, you study them.
I have been that in the past. And I got to say, I'm a little bit better now. Like I got a Bowflex and I got that thing in the mail. Oh. And that was just like, oh, I'm screwed. I'm never. And the thing about a Bowflex is if you do it wrong, it's all about tension and wires and stuff. And you're likely to just slice open your carotid artery or something.
But you figured that out.
I was well motivated to like really pay attention to step one, make sure step one's done and move on to step two. And that went well.
Do you think you were, I mean, obviously we evolve, so, and you mature, but mature. Do you think like when you started to do plays in like, how old were you when you started doing, get into acting?
Fourth or fifth grade.
Yeah. Fourth grade, and you knew, were people looking at you like, oh, he's got something. This guy's good.
I don't know. It was, I played Eeyore, I remember, in Winnie the Pooh, and I remember being really, like, passionate about getting to the pathos of Eeyore. Like, I really thought that there was a sadness and a depth to that character that I wanted to mine. So I suspected I was a little too serious for the play. But I then in the summer between sixth and seventh grade, I did two plays, and then I was truly bit. And I remember one was called The Me That Nobody Knows, which was a musical written by inner city kids. The monologues were written by inner city kids, and then Broadway people wrote songs based on the things that they wrote. And I just remember singing in front of an audience and feeling connected to them and feeling like I was doing a good job and that everyone was kind of good with it. Like, we were all together in the same room. I was doing this thing. They were looking at me, and everybody, no one was uncomfortable, and it was all kind of good. And I remember being really bit by that.
Did your parents tell you, hey, James or Jimmy, you're really good?
Jimmy.
Did they call you Jimmy?
No.
Okay.
No, not so much. No. I wouldn't say, like, the best thing that I got from my parents was complete apathy toward whether or not I should be an actor. Like, they just didn't care. Like, it's up to you, you know, do what you want. They weren't really against it. They weren't really that for it either.
So you didn't have to really, did you try to prove to them that you were good? Were you always trying to, like, look at me, I'm great? Were you that guy? Were you that kid that was just like, I want everyone to know I'm great? Because look, I think I did. I think I have many times in my life where I'm like, I want to be great so people think, and that's obviously not the way to be.
Yeah, I definitely was like that. There was a time when I thought that if I couldn't be the greatest actor in the world, there was no point in trying at all. And then you come to realize that there's no real competition in art, you know, that all artists, we're all trying to just get honest with ourselves and then express what we find. And so, you would never want to do Rebel Without a Cause, like the remake. If you get the call, we're remaking Rebel Without a Cause, you want the lead. You know, you would never say yes to that because you cannot touch James Dean. And you can't, no success will be in redoing that. But I don't know if James Dean would make the greatest Spike, frankly.
Exactly.
You know? So I'm only trying to be the best me. And so in that way, there's no competition at all. And I suspect the same would be true with the other arts, you know, sculpture, you know, you can't, you know, if you ask a sculptor, you know, who's better, Michelangelo or Rodin, you know, be like, well, they were trying for different things. There were different people expressing different things. So, I mean, like,
see, we get into that too, and I've gotten to this on the past podcast where then you start comparing yourself, like, oh, because I would do that. I go, I love music so much. I love music more than anything in the world. I'm not the most amazing singer. I'm not the most amazing musician, but I love it. I love it. I'm like, but I shouldn't do it because, you know, so and so has such a great voice, and my voice isn't even on the left. I shouldn't do it. And that's not why you should do things. And it's taken me so long to understand that if you just enjoy it, you can't, the whole world isn't going to love what you do no matter what. Just do it because you love it. Because if you're not doing what you love, then I don't even know why you're here on this planet. So, and I've been on this planet a long time so far. And it's a short time if you think about it. But I feel like I don't want it to get too late in life where I miss out on things because I'm scared or I don't feel like, you know, I'm going to be great at that, or I just want to try to enjoy things. And have you always enjoyed acting? Have you always?
Yeah. You know, I primarily enjoyed being in a group of people that were functioning more or less harmoniously, you know, that was, I think that, and then the sense of connection of being on stage,
you got a message?
No, I'm just thinking. I think for me, art is an artist creating something that expresses their experience, and then they put the art out into the world to see, does anyone else react to this? Am I alone? You know? And then if the audience reacts to it, or if the public reacts to it, and the public says, wow, I recognize myself in that piece, whether it's painting or a TV show or whatever, then the artists who made it feel more connected, like, oh, I'm not alone. And the great thing about theater is that moment happens when you're in the same room with the audience, so you can see it happening. And it's powerful for the audience, too, because the audience is... if everything's working right, the audience is looking at the play going, oh, I felt that. I'm not alone. And then they see the other audience members react to it. And so they're not alone in the fact that the other, they're with a group of people who feel the same way or a similar way. And there's this wonderful sense of connection that starts to grow when a play is working. The opposite is true when a play is not working.
Oh, yeah. You know? This pretentious piece of shit. I remember I went to see it. I'm not going to even get into it. I remember I saw a play with a friend, and we were going to see a friend. But what are the odds of the person who's in the play's best friend or brother sitting right next to me?
Oh, no.
So I just, you know, I didn't say anything, but I was just like, no play needs to be four. I'm not, if a movie's more than 2 hours, I'm usually out, unless it's Forrest Gump. I'm not into it. If a play's more than 3 hours, fuck off. If a concert's more than 3 hours, fuck off. I don't have the patience for it. And I remember just going, oh my, do we have three intermissions? Is that right? I've never heard of that. Has that ever happened? And I think he heard some of that. And then when I went, I might have caught a nap, like a little doze. And then I remember backstage, he was like right there with me. And I go, oh my God. Oh my God. He's like, hey, this is Michael. I'm like, dude, I think I'm an idiot. And I know he said something.
I can do one better. I remember going to see, again in Chicago, this actor director in town had directed me in a really wonderful play. And I was hoping that he would use me again. He's a really good director. And he was acting in a play. And I went to see it. And the play really wasn't that good. He was at a good performance. And I thought that I owed him my honesty when I went backstage. So I told him that he was in a dog. And to see his face just fall was one of the...
Did he ever talk to you again?
No.
Yeah, no, that could ruin a friendship. It could.
Because he's got to go out there and hump that thing over the hill every night.
Oh, yeah, you made a mistake, James.
You can't rob someone of hope. You know?
Maybe the last night you say, hey, by the way, you done? This is it, right? You're not doing it. They're not extending the play, right? Yeah, you sure? Yeah. Oh, man, this is a dog, bro.
I did one play. It was The Marriage of Figaro, not the opera, but the play. And it's comedy, right? It's a biting comedy about class. And it was misdirected, and we didn't get one laugh in a month and a half. Just absolute crickets, not one laugh. And about 2 weeks into the run, it got to be kind of a relief to realize how bad the play was that we were doing, and just revel in how bad it was.
I guess that's all you can do. You got to, hey, what your survival tactic is, hey, this is what we're doing. Let's just bear down and, you know, fucking do it. Oh,
we're
my God.
Paid, but, you know, we have to do the play as directed, so we're just going to do this thing. But, yeah.
You know, I read that you were in a play, and they rolled you out on a wheel, and you were naked.
That was my professional debut, yeah.
And where was that?
That was at the Goodman Theater in Chicago.
How old were you?
24, I think.
And this is whole naked, but this is penis, balls, everything's out.
Oh, yeah. The artistic director was like, the Goodman was the big premier theater in Chicago. It had a much older audience, subscription base. And they had just hired a new, fiery, young artistic director. And he wanted to kick out. He wanted to get a younger subscription base. So he wanted all the old people to get offended, and so that he could have room to attract a younger audience and he could do edgier plays. And so he put nudity in every show in that first season. And
come out to see you because they heard Dong was in it? Did you hear that? Did you hear that Long Duck Dong's in this play? I'm going to go check out that play. Or did you get more? Were there more women or more guys or whatever that came to see the show? Because
I could hear the clicking of the opera glasses. It was a big house, And they would roll me out, and I'd hear, oh, here, click, 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 and everyone was like, with their little, you know, binoculars, their little...
Monocle, what are they called?
No, they're like, they're really old-fashioned.
Oh, yeah, 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 a little.
Flick out, and it's both eyes. I know. It's a little tiny pair of binoculars. But I remember the sprites, the guys who were playing the little fairies and sprites who were wheeling me out would show me pornography because I was strapped in the thing. So they would like shove pornography in front of me right before they rolled
to
me
to try and get you aroused.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Did it work?
No, hell no.
No, how could
you're about to be rolled out in front of 700 people? Like, there's no.
Well,
way.
Wait a minute. When that you say rolled, are you rolled upside down and up? Rolled upside down?
No, no, no. It was like on a
because
like on
the flippity flap. I was kept thinking if this is a wheel that's going like that around, it's gonna flap. It's gonna be too funny. People are going to be like, oh, there's his dick flapping up and down, up and down. Thank God. So did you, let me ask you this, because I would do this. Did you stretch it at first? Like, hey, I don't want it to be too cold, or I want to pull it down. I want to make it longer than it is. You had to.
I wish I would have thought of that.
Or maybe you're just fine.
I didn't try.
But you were quoted as saying after that, I could be naked anywhere. It didn't matter at that point after doing that.
Yeah. I mean, that got, you know, you'll survive after doing that. I don't know that I would say that it has no effect on me. You know, I don't know that I am entirely comfortable. I guess if it's for a good cause, like I did this play called Just Friends, where it was a picnic during World War II. Apparently, during World War II, people would go out into the fields and watch the German bombers come over on their way to London, and they would actually picnic and watch this. And it was a man who was discovering that he was gay, meeting a openly gay artist, and them sitting down and having a talk and a picnic together. And at the end of the play, the artist that I play, the artist takes off all his clothes, and there's a pause, and the gay, the man who's discovering himself takes off all his clothes. And then they lay down to sunbathe, and it's lights out. And it's just called Just Friends. Like, they're not going to become lovers. They're just there for each other as human beings. They're just talking about themselves. And it's really cool. And in that way, I was very happy to do the nudity. You know, it served, like, a real purpose there. If the nudity is just for titillation, I'm a lot less comfortable with it.
Yeah. Inside of You is brought to you by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. This is an amazing platform. I use it on both podcasts. It has worked wonders for me. It's so amazing how easy it is to navigate. If you want to sell products, t-shirts, soap scents, whatever it is, Ryan, you want to sell, this is the way to do it. You could see what your best seller is right there, analytics, how much you're making this month, what products are selling the best. It's really fantastic. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage, Shopify's there to help you grow.
Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered.
Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Plus, Shopify's extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way.
Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/inside, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/inside now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/inside.
What's up, everyone? It's Reality Steve, your number one source for all things Bachelor Nation and reality TV. Every day, I'm giving you the behind-the-scenes juice and your info on all your Bachelor Nation stories, and also interviewing some of your favorite reality stars. My name has been synonymous with spoilers, but I'm so much more than that. Give me a listen.
The Reality Steve Podcast. part of the Believe Network. Just search BLEAV on YouTube or wherever you listen.
Let me ask you, did your life completely change when you got Buffy? Did that was that the sort of the turning point of like, okay, this is the next level. People are, had you ever really been recognized as much, or was it really Buffy that did that?
Oh, it was absolutely Buffy. It was a night and day. I mean, like I would get like when you're doing theater, you might have someone stop you out taking a walk, and someone would stop you and say, I saw you at Macbeth last night. You were very nice. Or, you know, there would be that thing kind of going on. But that was night and day from the kind of thing that happened during Buffy. And I was afraid of being famous. I was terrified that I would lose my soul and become a douchebag if I got famous. I did this. We're talking so much about theater, but it's formative for me. So, were you part of the Thespian Society in high school?
No, I did a play in high school. I took drama for 4 years, then I did a play, and then when I went to college, I started doing more and more plays and got involved.
Yeah. There's the drama club, the nationwide drama club, Society, right? So every other year, they would go to Ball State University and have a convention, and for that convention, they would have a play that was cast from all around the country. And my senior year was coincided with this convention, and that year's play was Godspell, and they cast me as Jesus in the play. And within the confines of Ball State University, we were like the Who in 1972. We were like Led Zeppelin in 70, you know. We had to have bodyguards. We had to be shuttled around.
What?
We had people like breaking into our dorm rooms.
The Thespian Club, the Thespian Society.
Yeah. It was this weird thing. And like after the play, the audience like stormed the stage and they started tearing my costume off, you know, trying to get bits of the costume.
What?
And stuff. Yeah. And I remember thinking like, I'm really glad this is happening to me at age 18, because now I know I don't want to go to Hollywood. This is not what I want. So I will stay in theater where it's not, you know, being super famous is not usually in the cards.
I would have ran. I would have just like, yes, take me away, Calgon. This is awesome. And then, of course, you figure it out. Yeah. So you experienced that. But like, well, first of all, I want to go back because I know you've told this story, but I like to twist it up a little bit if possible. So when you get Buffy, is it something like you obviously auditioned for it?
Yeah.
And did they want English accent?
They did. They asked me if I could do any other accents. I said, yeah, I can do quite a lot of different accents. And they said, well, give us another one. And I had done a play where I used like a deep, like a Louisiana accent, like deep, deep on South, way on down Louisiana, like that. And again, I was playing a killer, and the killer was on the phone with the lead of the play. And we were getting all of these laughs that we didn't plan on having. And I remember asking the director, why are we getting these laughs? And he said, well, they can't see your face and you're using that accent. They think you're black. So it's playing differently than I wrote it, but it's actually working very well. And I was like, okay. And I thought when they asked me later during the Buffy audition, like what other accent, I thought, well, because he said that the accent that you're using would have been a white accent, say 150 years ago, but in modern times, it's only black people would use that accent now, so they think you're black. So I thought, wow, a vampire, that would be a fun accent to use that one.
I'm a vampire.
So I did that as well. But I mean, like, Joss Whedon, the guy who did Buffy, who made it up, he wanted an English punk rock vampire. And it's not surprising that he said, no, that's cute. That other accent's very cute, but I want what I want.
What did you wear for the audition?
I imagine the character was really scruffy. So I wore this old black T-shirt that I'd had for like 15 years. Most of my clothes at this point, I was really poor. So most of the clothes I had for 15 years, but this black T-shirt, you know, like, have you ever had one of those T-shirts that you wash it so often that all the cotton is gone?
Yes.
And from the blend, and you only have the synthetic stuff behind, you know?
Yeah.
Because that was the most messed up T-shirt that I had that wasn't full of holes. And they loved that t-shirt. And in fact, they used that t-shirt for the first few episodes. Maybe all of season two, we used that t-shirt. And what had been like a dish rag in my life suddenly became
rags
like the
riches.
Shroud of Turin, because they couldn't double it. They couldn't find a t-shirt that was that messed up. So there's only one of them. So that whenever I had that, whenever I was in costume, they're like, no, be careful, you're drinking coffee. Don't get it on the t-shirt. Be careful with the t-shirt. And I was just like,
did you know in the room when you're reading for Joss? You read for Joss, obviously.
Yeah, Joss and a whole bunch of people.
Did you really milk it? Did you turn it on with that accent? Because that accent, surprisingly, I know you've heard it, but it's like most people think you're English. And then they meet you, yeah. And they're like, holy shit, he's not.
I think the accent was not actually that great in the first bit. I think it got better as time. Like, if you do anything for 6 years, you'll probably get pretty good at it, you know? And, right. And I think by the end of it, it was really a credible accent. But in the beginning, it wasn't that great. But I thought I was great. And yes, I remember, this is great. I remember being so proud that I was from theater, and that I thought that I had much more experience than anyone else auditioning. So I remember being out in the audition room and facing a wall doing Shakespeare monologues really loudly, just so everyone else would think, oh, that's a real actor. I'm screwed. I was trying to mess with people, not realizing nobody cares about Shakespeare in Los Angeles. No one did.
Did they
people
hate you?
They just thought the people in the audition room, they thought I was psychotic, I bet, I imagine.
'Tis called the evil, a most miraculous work of this good king, which oft since my hair remained in England, I have seen him do. I mean, it's like, what the fuck is he doing?
Exactly.
He's on Buffy.
And then finding out that insane man got the role, he's just like, I quit. Forget it.
And you hear about this because I'm one that can relate to you about the hair and the bleach, and I had to shave my head, so we could relate to it. But like it really burned your scalp. Like it hurt.
Oh, so bad. So bad. Yeah. Because it was just because we had to do it every episode. We had to do it every 8 days because a vampire's dead. So the hair doesn't grow. So you can't have roots. So on the bottle, it says only do this every 6 weeks. It's not safe to do it more often than that. And we were doing it every 8 days. So when you bleach, you would get blisters. You get blisters on your skull. Because it's really heavy chemical. And so we were pouring bleach on top of the open wounds from the last bleaching like every 8 days.
Did you think that you were going to maybe not grow your hair out? Like you're going to lose your hair? You're going to go bald? You're going to be scarred for life?
Yeah, they would say, we don't know if you're going to have hair by the end of this. And I was like, screw it, pay me. I'll buy hair. You know, like after 15 years of abject poverty, the hair was my last concern.
Wow.
I was just trying to make money to... Because I became a father, so I moved down to Los Angeles to try to buy diapers and healthcare and stuff like that. And so, you know, at that point, hair schmear.
Hair schmear. But, you know.
I don't know how to do anything else. And, you know, like, keep paying me. I'll do, Jesus.
I mean, you're acting. You're doing something you love. You know, the character wasn't supposed to be around very long. And then, you know, the fans loved you. Did you feel like, I'm going to renegotiate and they're not going to pay me this guest rate shit? And I'm going to get paid salary and I'm going to get paid fairly because I'm an integral part of this mofo show.
No, I was only signed to 1 year. And the whole idea was they told me you would be in between 5 and 10 episodes. And so my whole deal was just to try to make it closer to 10 than 5. That was the whole thing. And then at the end of season 2 on Buffy, but the job was over. And I do remember thinking, try to do it without me, guys. My rock. And then I remember tuning in to season 3, which I wasn't in at the time, and they had a character called Faith that Eliza Dushku was doing. And that was freaking awesome. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, they don't need me at all.
But they did.
I don't know. I think that it was a character that the writers enjoyed exploring.
You guys got along real well, you and Joss.
No, I was terrified of Joss.
Really?
Absolutely terrible.
I've never met him, but he seemed. I thought he was just
such a nice guy,
gentleman,
yeah.
Right?
But the thing is that I was imperiling the theme of Buffy, which is that Buffy is actually the same theme as Hamlet, which is how do you get through adolescence? How do you see the world as screwed up and not give up? How do you take arms against the sea of troubles? How do you make a positive difference in the world? And vampires in Buffy are just metaphors for all of the challenges that you face in that period. And so, you know, Joss felt that vampires should be ugly they should be very quickly overcome. And they were not supposed to be sexy. He said, I don't like that Anne Rice crap. And he got talked into one romantic interest vampire. That was Angel. It wasn't his idea. And that was the only one. That was the exception. And then I came along, and I wasn't designed to be a romantic character, but then the audience reacted that way to it. And I remember he backed me up against a wall one day, and he was just like, I don't care how popular you are, kid. You're dead. You hear me? You're dead, dead. And I was just like, you know, it's your football, man. Like, okay, you know.
Wait, was he kidding around?
No, hell no. Hell no.
He was angry with you?
He was angry at the situation, I think.
Did he ever apologize?
No, why should he? If it had been me in his shoes, I'd have killed me off just immediately.
So wait. You're saying he resented you because of your popularity?
He resented a situation where he had to deal with another romantic vampire when his theme was that vampires are the problems you have to get over in high school. In season two, when he's trying to hold on to a really good theme, and it's getting corrupted by a surprise character.
Right.
And I like, evil is not cool. You know, evil. And I think that a lot of what we do in Los Angeles and Hollywood, when we portray evil as cool, I think that we're really lying. I think that evil is stupid and laughable and it should not be portrayed as cool. And I really respect Joss that he is not interested in portraying evil as cool. And yeah, I mean, if I had been producing that show and I had been in control and Spike was getting romantic thing, I just would have slit his throat right away.
Right.
I would just protect the theme. Yeah.
What's your favorite?
I don't think I'm as brave as Joss. Joss decided to like deal with it, you know, and trying to find a way to explore that.
Who did you love working with most? Like, if you remember, like off the cuff, like right at the top of your head.
Anthony Head played Giles, the older guy, the librarian. Yep. He was hands down the best actor on the show. I remember I did my first scene with him, and I remember thinking, "Old man, would you wake up? I'm going to mop the floor with you, man." Because he wasn't doing anything. He was kind of mumbling. And I didn't catch it. And then I saw the episode and he just, there was no need to watch me. It was all about him because he wasn't lying. He wasn't performing. He wasn't trying to impress anybody. He was just letting you stare at him as he figured stuff out. And it was fascinating. Wow. And I remember realizing that I had to go back to zero. And I had come in so proud of all of my tools from stage and very few of them were going to be useful in front of a camera. And so I would watch Tony and I would come in, even if I wasn't in the scene, I would just sit on an app box and watch him work and notice what he was doing. And most importantly, what he was not doing, he was not pushing it out. He was just experiencing something that the camera could document. He was giving himself an actual experience that the camera could then record.
Do you have a strong work ethic? Do you, are you hard on yourself? Do you learn lines easily? Do you get nervous on set? Do you let things kind of overwhelm you? Is there that kind of essence that you sort of carry on around when you're working?
I don't know if I get nervous. No, I don't get nervous. In fact, when things go really wrong on set, I love that.
Really?
Because then I get a chance to show off, you know, like we have to get this shot. We're out of time. You know, I love that.
Really?
Yeah, really
you want to be the go-to guy.
Yeah, because I mean, I know my lines, man. I'm like, okay, let's jump off the cliff. We have to do it. This is exciting, you know. But I've learned that in order to have fun, I have to know my lines really well. Because if I don't know my lines so well, then I'm sweating it, and then it's very stressful. But if I know my lines so well that they just come out, like I think Kubrick said, the actor should know their lines so well that they can't say them wrong. And I think that there's a lot to that. So I put a lot of effort into knowing my lines. So I just can press a button and it just comes out. And so then I can start thinking about all the things, not the words, but all the things that I'm thinking why I'm saying the words. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I absolutely. Talk to someone and look at something and grab something and like open a book and like do things and not think of your lines. And that's what people do. I'm like looking at something. I'm like, yeah, so James, and I'm drinking my club soda. And I just want to have a conversation. Exactly. That's exactly why you want to know your lines. And you can always tell.
I'm wondering when I can sneak another sip of coffee.
Yeah.
You know, I got my coffee over there. And a lot of times I'm looking over. I should keep talking right now. I was waiting until Michael's making a point. And I'm
going
to go.
And you could see the people struggling that are just like going, I just want to get, I looked into the mirror last night and I went over my lines and these are the lines and that's it. And please don't have me do anything else. And that's all, you know, whatever. What's the line that fans, when you go to these cons, because I've seen you at the cons and they love you and you play music and you all these things. What's the quote? They always say, will you say this line? Is there a line that is your favorite or their favorite or that you go, oh, this one again, I have to say. Like mine is, I am the villain of the story. So what's yours?
Out for a walk, bitch. That's it. I only have to say five words.
Out for a walk, bitch.
Yeah, yeah.
But you said it a certain way.
Yeah, but Buffy finds Spike outside her house staring into the window. She's like, Spike, what are you doing here? In five words or less. And he's all completely embarrassed that he's been caught. He's in love with her. She's not in love with him yet. And he's totally embarrassed. And he's like, well, out for a walk, bitch.
That's
it's a great line. It's a great line.
Do you remember working on Smallville with me and Tom? And
Yeah.
What do you remember about that experience? Because I remember, you know, and Tom loves you, by the way. Every time we see you somewhere, he's like, oh, I like that guy.
He's the whole cast, man. That was such a great experience, man. I remember being on set with you and having publicity wanting to stoke a competition between you and I, and the fact that you and I would not have it. And we would just not feed into that at all. And we were just like, no, this is a cool guy, man. I can't wait to act with him. It's going to be a lot of fun. And they kept asking me questions like, yeah, don't you think you're going to get over on him on today? Aren't you going to, who's the better actor? Who's the bigger badass? I'm like, oh my God. You know, I remember the humiliation of acting with Tom Welling. Cause we would do a lot of walk and talks and I'm not Tom Welling tall. So when you have, you know, the close-up shot of both of us in the shot, if you want me in the shot, you have to put me up on apple boxes. And so when we're walking, they would have to like tape 15 to 50 apple boxes together in a big ramp to have
me. How tall are you?
5'9".
That's a reasonable height, but he's 6'5". He's 6'5". Yeah. I had to deal with it too, and I was Lex Luthor. And I was like looking up at him going, listen, you motherfucker. You know, and it's like, Jesus, you know. But
did you stand on an apple box?
Occasionally I would. You know, I'd say, hey, guys, I want an apple box. And the director would go, what, are you suddenly going to be taller than Tom? Mm-hmm. I'm like, all right, split the difference. Half an apple. Well, dude, you know, and I know that you love playing music. I know that you had a band. I know you broke up. I know you got back together and did some things. I had a band too, and it's sort of like every actor has a band. It's like, I just, no, what it is I love music. You love music. So having a band is not easy. Now you hear all these stories when bands break up and you're like, what the fuck? They can't get along. They have these hits. They do this. I'm in this little band that nobody knows and we can't get it together. You know?
Yeah.
Was it tough?
I think that you're dealing with people's inner child when you're dealing with artists. A lot of artists, you know, we say that we feel whole when we're doing our art, and that's because our inner child only feels comfortable enough to come out into the sunshine when there's a structure and a safety. And art provides, I think, that for me anyway, that structure and that safety. And I've noticed it, you know, it's the same thing, you know, rehearsing a play or any mass artistic endeavor. And people come in with ideas and they come up with instincts and they're basically sharing what their inner child is wanting to show. And if you disagree with it, you're basically telling the other person's inner child, fuck you, go back into the darkness. And it can get really passionate.
All right. Listen, this is shit talking I guess it's shit talking with James Marsters, but these are Patreon fans. So this is, Patron, this is their fans. They have questions. They're my patrons. They're awesome, and they have some questions. So this is Spitfire. So you go, boom. You answer them. You don't have to, you know. Anna A, if you could add or change one thing about Spike's character, what would it be?
Not a goddamn thing.
Really, not one thing.
Not a goddamn thing.
How about the color of his hair?
No, looked fucking fabulous. Are you kidding me?
You did look fabulous.
I was gorgeous.
But you suffered.
Oh my God.
You suffered, man. You suffered for art.
Yeah, but I look good. And in Los Angeles, it's better to look good than to feel good.
Fernando said that on Saturday Night Live. Billy Crystal's kid goes, you know, my daddy always told me, he said, Fernando, don't be a schnook. It's not how you feel. It's how you look. He looked my... You look absolutely. Judith D, dear James, what did you think of the series finale of Angel? I thought it was beautiful and epic. I just like Buffy's.
Yeah, that would be the one thing I would change about Angel. They dumped ice water on us for 18 hours because we got canceled by surprise, so they couldn't save back enough money to make a big epic ending. So they just dumped huge water on us. And they forgot to park the water truck in the sun, so the water was ice cold. And I was already coughing up blood. I was so sick by the end of that season, and they were just frozen.
I bet Boreanaz lost his shit.
No, man, we muscled out. None of us actually bitched about it. But we were muttering.
That's because I wasn't there.
You know, because you can see your breath, and then like an action.
Leanne P., I mean, you just said this. Any fun, cool behind-the-scene moments from Smallville that you would like to share? But, I mean, you know.
Yeah. I remember coming on the set. And finding out that the stuntman, who was the head of the department and also doubled Tom, had just taken an 18-foot fall, that his wire broke.
Yeah, everybody thought he was dead.
Yeah,
he fell, and he wasn't all his. But they said his body, the sound it made was. They thought he was dead. Somehow he rehabilitated and he's fine. I mean, obviously, you know, but I don't know how he lived. Was it 25 feet, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was insane. And, like, it wasn't the first time, like, that kind of thing had happened over on Buffy. That's, like, it's actually dangerous. Stunts are actually dangerous.
Oh,
and,
man. So brave.
And that was the day that they were going to put me in a big mechanical arm to fly me, like Superman had just punched me, and then I have to go twirling through space or whatever.
Right.
And so they had to, like, manipulate me, and I was just, like, really today?
Oh my god.
Okay, you know, let's buckle me up.
Todd, do you have a favorite show that you'd love to have a guest role in?
Dark.
Dude,
Dark.
But here's the thing. The first season was probably the best show I've seen in years.
Right?
Unbelievable, that show.
And the thing is that this is supposed to be rapid fire. I'm incapable of rapid fire
with both of us.
I apologize. But I always imagine the director on Dark because he gives the same note every take, I imagine. Stop acting. Less, please. Less, less, less. Because the actors is so good because the actors are doing nothing.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's so simple and it's so effective.
What if we just did this interview like nothing? Like, so, I don't know. Are you happy? All right, Lisa H., is your side project Vidiots done? You and Mark were just hilarious and that definitely a comedy duo.
Oh man, yeah. Mark became a father, and he is now got a real job, so he's not coming out with me to conventions, which is where we filmed Vidiots, I'm afraid. So right now it's if we can figure out a way to keep it going, we will. But for now, it's iced.
Brian H., how did you get the gig to do the audiobooks for the Dresden Files, and who's your favorite character to read?
I don't know why they chose me. I have no clue. But Jim Butcher, who writes the Dresden Files, they asked him who he wanted. They said me. I remember thinking that it would be an easy job and finding very quickly that it was a very difficult job. Have you ever done a book on tape, Mike?
Yeah. It's a lot. It's a lot of work.
It's a lot, right?
It is.
I remember I came back from lunch and the director was surprised. He's like, you TV actors, you usually go out for lunch, you don't come back. So good for you. At least you're doing that. my favorite character is Bob the Scowl because he's got a very interesting accent and he's a disembodied spirit that lives in a skull and he can't get out and he's horny all the time, so he's a pervert. So he's always talking about trying to get pornography into the skull and no one will give it to him.
You are damn good with these accents. It's unbelievable. It's so funny too when they read. I get nervous because, like, you know, you tell me to read something, I'm like, all right, I'll read these questions. I don't think about it. And you say, all right, read. And you're like, right before they are rolling and they're like ready, I'm just like, like, you got to get started. Like, the first day was tough. Okay, Thomas T., I met you at a Comic-Con. My wife and I were dressed as Lois and Clark, and you took a video of us at his table, at your table. I'm curious, what's the best cosplay you've seen and taken a video of? What's the best? I mean, really? Do you just videotape other cosplay people?
Yeah, yeah. It's the thing I do. If you're dressed in cosplay of any show that I've done, then I just take you a quick video where you know I would be like, "Hi, I'm James and I'm Spike," and that's it. That's all you got to do. And then I just put those together into a short film, and then have an audience clapping at the end. And then I just put that on social media after the con.
And what's the best one?
There was a Zamasu from Dragon Ball Super. I played Zamasu in Dragon Ball Super, and it's a really wild character. He's a god, and he's got, you know, enormous hair and, you know, big shoulders and everything. And someone just had it down to a T.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. I think you and I are a lot alike in terms of, like, the cons to me are sort of, they feel like home in a way. They just feel like, you know, I love getting toys and posters and things, and I just love it there. I feel at home. I went to those before I became anything, anyone. I went to horror conventions and
me too.
Yeah.
I love it. I was dressed as Spock.
Really?
I had pointed ears. I had the tricorder. I had the tunic. I had everything in a big blonde afro because I could not control my hair when I was 13 years old.
Can you do a Spock accent?
Yeah. I don't think he has one.
No.
I can go like that.
But doesn't, yeah, the original Leonard Nimoy.
I don't know. I'm not really a mimic, to tell you the truth. It's hard for me to mimic another person.
He has a deep voice.
I can do accents, but it's a different thing.
What's the one impression you go to? Can you do one impression of someone?
No. Oh, man. As soon as I'm walking around my house, you're going to be like, oh, I should have done that. Nothing comes to mind.
Because you do so many accents. You think there's the, you know, if you just, you probably do, what's his name? Picard. You could probably, if you listen to him, do Picard.
Data, make it so. No, but I'm just doing a plummy accent. That's all I'm doing. That's not Stewart.
But Patrick. It's in essence a Stewart.
Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Okay.
What was wrong with that?
Okay.
I remember, I can't do James Mason, but remember James Mason?
Yeah, yeah. Right?
He had something, I can't do it, but I know there's one line that goes, hello. He would do that. Hello, Jim. It's time to go now. Or something like that, right? James Mason, good, Salem's actually, yeah. Lot. Put it down. Give it to the monster. Something, I forgot what it was. Dude, this has been so fun. I'm glad we finally got to do this. We've talked about it. And I know you're busy. And I know you got a family. And it's just like, I'm glad you opened up and you're able to hang out with me.
Totally, man. I've been looking forward to this ever since you asked me. For the last week and a half, I've been telling everybody, I'm on Rosenbaum's podcast.
And what's next? I know everybody's sort of like, I don't know what's next, because we're kind of like, you can't really act. You can't do, are you doing anything?
Yeah, well, I'm waiting. We just finished a pitch to DC for an idea for a comic book series that I've had for a number of years that I probably shouldn't talk about, but it's super freaking awesome. And we've pitched it, and our contact at DC is gonna send our pitch up the ladder and see if we get a comic book. And we're just waiting on that. I'm hoping, because it's the perfect thing to do during a lockdown, is write.
Oh, yeah. You know?
And then I just finished the next Dresden File book called Peace Talks, and that'll be coming out in a few weeks, I think.
So you just set up your recorder at home and do it there?
No, I went to the studio.
Well, think about it. It's probably you in a room. That's it.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you go in, wipe down the room, and make sure no one comes in, adjust your own mic, and you're fine.
Would you ever do a Buffy reunion?
Yeah. I told Joss during Angel that if he called me for anything, whether it's one line or 50, I'd come no matter where I was in the world. But if he wanted to film me doing Spike, he had 7 years, because I'm aging and Spike's a vampire, and I don't want to play an aged Spike. You know, like, I would do Spike now, be like, what happened to Spike? He looks like shit.
Have you seen, like, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? I almost said euthanized. Because they youngenized. You can look younger. And you look good, too. What are you talking about? Your skin looks good, at least from my vantage point on screen. I mean, what are you talking about? You're younger than me, asshole.
The face changes. I don't know. Yes, if there was a way, or if Spike was always in vampire face, then that might work. So, sure, you know.
Yeah, man,
if Joss wanted me to work again, I would just really want to protect that idea that he's, he's a vampire. He doesn't age. That's one of the core things about being a vampire.
Do you still talk to him?
Explain it away. What's that?
Do you still talk to Joss or Sarah or any of those guys? Anybody?
Yeah, you know, I email Sarah once in a while. We brag about our kids. I think my kids are more impressive. So in my mind, I beat her every single time because her kids are much younger than mine.
Right.
Joss, no, I saw him. Last time I saw Joss was during the Entertainment Weekly photo shoot where we were. It was the 20th year anniversary or whatever. And we did a photo shoot and I got to talk with him a bit, you know, and I found he was the same Joss. Like I thought maybe he'd have changed after Avengers and everything. Like he'd be like Mr. Important guy. And he was the same Joss. He was racked by self-doubt, just like always. I love that guy.
James, thanks for doing this. And I appreciate it. Best luck. What's your handle, by the way, your Twitter and Instagram so people can follow you?
James Marsters of as an official, but just OF is on Twitter. And then the official James Marsters Facebook page.
Well, I'd love to do this again. I'd love to, when this is over, go have a beer or something.
I would love it.
Talk about the old days. We're getting to that age where I'm like, well, what? You're like 10 years younger than me, aren't you?
No, I'm 58.
What?
Yeah.
You're older than me?
Am I? Okay.
I didn't know you were older than me. I thought you were younger than me. I swear to God.
Bastard. Mike, I have this light that my wife gave me. Look at that.
You know, I have a light in there. I have a light in the other room, too.
Hey, put this light right in your face.
But you look good.
It takes 10 years off. Here, I'll turn it off for you. Oh, my God.
Still look great. You know, there was a moment, I think I've talked about this, but I remember one day it's 5 a.m. and I'm in the makeup trailer and I'm shaving my face with an electric razor. And the makeup artist, Natalie, goes, "Oh, Michael, that's Tom's razor." And I go, "Oh, no wonder I was feeling so gorgeous for a second." And then I went back to my old razor and I was like, "Oh, the horror. I'm hideous." I think I posted that somewhere. Dude, I love you. Thank you again. And thank you. Please say thanks to your wife for letting you use her phone. For this.
She saved the whole deal, man.
She did, man. This would have been shitty.
I'll cook for her tonight.
Thanks for allowing me to be inside of you. That's what I say.
Oof, baby.
Ooh.
Don't tell my wife.
Hey! All right, I won't.
Shut up. God damn it.
All right. Well, thank you, James Marsters. That I enjoyed that. I had never really talked to him that much because he was on Smallville with me and we see each other at conventions. But it's like, hey, dude. And I don't remember really having in-depth conversations with him before today. And it just was I just have a brand new respect. It's amazing when you just take a minute to get to know someone. You could learn so much. And I've done that with so many guests where I'm like, wow, I like this person. That's why you shouldn't judge others. You shouldn't say, oh, I heard that guy's an asshole, so he must be an asshole. No, I heard she's a bitch. Why? Because someone heard that she was a bitch. Try to be open-minded, man. I do it. I can judge, man. I am Mike Judge. I am Judge Judy. I am Judy Dench Judge. That didn't make sense. Let me just read. By the way, I just want to say a big shout out to all the patrons who support this podcast. I love you more than you know. Thank you. Anybody who wants to join Patreon, check it out. Go to the Patreon app and you can join. There's so many cool tiers and communities. And I do YouTube lives for everyone where I play music and they recommend songs. And, you know, you just get discounts on stuff and just so much good stuff. There's so much. Just look at the tiers and maybe you want to join. If not, thank you for just listening and subscribing. Please look at the, please follow us and Inside You at Inside You Podcast, Instagram, Facebook, at Inside You Pod on Twitter and subscribe on YouTube. That's a big one too. We're growing. We started like 18,000. I think we have over 50,000 subscribers now or something like that. But please watch and listen. If you could do both, that'd be amazing. Wow. Listen and watch. I would owe you. Do you understand me? Here's a fan letter. I won't read the whole thing. This is from Candy. Miss Candy. She is so supportive and loving. And it seems like everything I do, she's a wonderful person and she has a huge heart. And I just, I really appreciate her. And I want to read something that she said. Love your podcast. It's so inspiring and holds my interest. Great therapy. This is one of the best podcasts I have ever listened to. I can relate to most of the inspiring stories your guests talk about. I love that you and your guests are so honest and open about their lives and issues and can talk about it. it's hard to find people that are true to their self and can be honest and are not fake. You know, thank you. Candy, you're so amazing. And it's funny because I didn't even know this was your letter. I just started looking. I go, wow, this is from Candy. And Candy is a cancer and domestic violence survivor. And she has a heart of gold. A heart of gold. And that's what it's like. You know, that's what it is. That's what it's about, is what I'm trying to say. Shit. So thank you, Candy. Thank you for writing in. And it means a lot. Here's another one. Michael, thank you for creating both your podcasts. Well, one is gone now, but I still have the Inside You podcast, so thank you. This is from Valerie. It seems when I listen to each one that something in it is something I needed to hear at that moment. You see, I don't love myself anymore. Probably because the last man I gave love to died by suicide in June. And I'm struggling every day to know why I was not enough for him to overcome his pain. And stay. I'm learning I couldn't have stopped him, but my heart hasn't caught up. Anyway, thanks, Michael. Valerie, that's tremendously sad. And, you know, I think if you look at history and you look at people that have committed suicide, you know, there's probably not one person who hasn't said, I wish I could have. that's something that is going to happen with any kind of death for the most part. I mean, obviously suicide, you feel, you know, like, oh my God, I didn't know they were that sad. I didn't know this. I think when you're in a certain state of mind, like he was maybe, and again, I'm not Dr. Rosenbaum. I'm just kind of from friends and from people I've known that have committed suicide and people who have experienced it and had loved ones that, you know, I just feel like when they're in that mindset, there's nothing anybody could have said or could have done. And, you know, like the Robin Williams thing, you know, everybody's like, why would he do? He was in pain and, you know, things were going on in his mind that no one could understand except him, I assume. So I don't, Valerie, don't you get down on what you could have done, or you'll find love again and you deserve it. We all deserve it. And I'm sorry. I really am sorry. It's a terrible thing when someone passes, especially in that manner. So I could just say, you know, I love you, Val, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of people love you and care about you. So stay positive and, you know, be healthy. You know, he didn't want to be here, obviously, for some reason. So you, why don't you live the life that you wish he could have had? Be as happy as you can. Be as present as you can. And I don't know. I'm probably spitballing here, but I'm just trying to speak from the heart. Big shout outs. You know, first of all, obviously, I just did the GalaxyCon virtual thing on Sunday. It was fantastic. A lot of fun Zooms with fans, and I'm doing another one for Informa. So if you want to do Zooms and autographs and all that stuff, we're doing a virtual one, Smallville Informa, July 30th or 27th. Look online. I'll post something, but Informa. Again, new Inside of You masks and mugs. They're online at the Inside of You store. Join Patreon if you so desire. Inside of You podcast on Patreon, and Where Have All the Good Horror Movies Gone on Patreon. It's always nice to see new people, and I like to message them and say welcome. And it is me. I do not allow Bryce to make comments unless someone's looking at something that's wrong with their site. So it is me. I always say Rosie or Rosenbaum, but you know it's me by the way I speak. No one speaks like me, like an idiot. Okay, here are the shout-outs. Nancy D, Mary B. I know all these names. I mean, I could say their last names. I'm not going to. Nancy D, Mary B, Leah S, Trisha F, Sarah V, Yukiko, Jill E, Brian H, Lauren G, Nico P, Barry I, Angelina G,
Jerry W., Kevin R., Emily K., Bob B., Robert B., Jason W., Kristen K. I always think Kristen Krook, but I know it's the other Kristen. Hi, Kristen. Amelia O., Amelia. Sorry, Allison L., Jason D., Raj, Joshua D., Emily S., CJP, Samantha M., Hamza B., Jennifer N., Stacy B., Carly T., Reem, Jennifer S., Janelle B., Tabitha 272, Kimberly E., Melissa C., Mike E., Jake M., Marisa N., hi, Marissa, Judith D., Ramira, Beth B., Chris F., Sarah F., Chad W., Leanne P., we're almost done, Darla W., Jackie P., Rodrigo S., Rachel C., Ray A., Ray A., Ray A., A., Maya P., Morgan D., DeMario, Jennifer C., Maddie S., Tiffany L., Kendrick F., Ashley E., Kelly W., Sigourney P., Tom T., Matt W., Belinda N., Benjamin R. Those are the top tier patrons. They are amazing. They support the podcast. They keep it going. If, you know, you want to help out, sure. I ain't gonna yell at you. I'm going to give you love, man. I'm going to give you some love. Thank you for listening again. Make sure you subscribe. Email all your friends. Make sure they subscribe and write reviews. If I don't get back to you, it takes a couple months for the hello@insideofyoupodcast.com. If you leave a message, it could take time. I can't do this many things at the same time. Ryan's not here. I don't have my wonderful Jessica, who you've heard about, my assistant. She's wonderful. She's not with me anymore, but we're on great terms. It wasn't like that. And I love her. And hi, come on. We have a special guest. Come here. Come on. Come on. Ugh. Look at the special guest here. I've got my doggy Blanche as I end the show. You came in at the right time, didn't you? She's a good girl and she smells good. Breathe in the microphone. You hear that? That's her nose. I love you all. Thank you all for allowing me to be inside of you today. And another big shout out to my patrons. On the horror, where have all the horror movies gone? Good horror movies gone. Inside of you, Patreon. And Bryce and Ryan, I love you. And I wish everybody the best. Have a great freaking week, man. And stay safe, stay healthy, do something positive. And my, what is it, Blanche? Thank you. Can you stop? I love you. Foodonfoot.org, Ronald McDonald House of Los Angeles, Echoes of Hope. Shout out to all my charities. I love you guys. Thank you.
Welcome to Talkville,
the ultimate Smallville rewatch podcast. Guest star Sarah Carter as Alicia Baker.
Although I didn't really work with her a lot.
But Tom did, and they had some real big smoochy scenes.
Yeah. Should we talk about that?
Could there be any more sex? What was a three-page makeout scene that just kept going? Good Lord. We get it. They have chemistry.
Jump in now or catch up on any of the past seasons of Talkville on YouTube or wherever you listen.